Hi, I'm Art Kaplan, Head of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine. I want to welcome you to Medscape's ongoing series, Both Sides Now. Today, we're going to take a look at a controversial topic: should physicians override parental decision-making authority in the case of their sick child? In the vast majority of cases, medical treatment decisions are made for children without much conflict between families and physicians. However, in an important minority of cases, conflict arises to varying degrees. Several recent cases in which physicians and parents disagreed about treatment decisions have made national headlines. The case of 11-month-old Charlie Gard is one. Charlie suffered from a mitochondrial disease, very rare, wound up on a ventilator at the Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London. His parents wanted their son to receive an experimental treatment. The hospital took them to court, believing that that experimental treatment wasn't really in Charlie's best interest and that he should be removed from life support and allowed to die. In April of 2017, the United Kingdom's High Court ruled that it was in the infant's best interest for his treating clinicians to remove the ventilator. Mechanical ventilation was withdrawn and the infant died the next day. In another recent case, 18-month-old Ezekiel Stefan died of meningitis in a small town in Manitoba, Canada, after his parents chose to pursue alternative medicine. The boy died, and the parents were put on trial for child neglect. And still another case. Last year, a Michigan couple were charged with involuntary manslaughter. Their baby Abigail was delivered by a midwife who didn't see any problems when the child was delivered. But the next day, the midwife saw that the baby was severely jaundiced, and she urged the parents to take the baby to the doctor or to a hospital. Parents didn't do that. The child died. The issue of overriding parental authority for a sick child is clearly not black and white, plenty of gray. Today, we have two guests who I think can shed light on the pros and cons of this complicated topic. Dr. Moshe Cohen, Assistant Professor of Pediatric Critical Care and Pediatric Palliative Care at the Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at NYU Langone Medical Center. He feels that in certain circumstances, parental authority should be overridden by physicians. Dr. Chris Johnson, the Medical Director of Pediatric Intensive Care at the CentraCare Health System and Clinical Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Kansas, supports parents having decision-making authority in certain circumstances. Let me welcome both of you and thank you for being on today's program.
Thanks, Dr. Kaplan.
It's good to be here.
I saw a statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics not too long ago that said you have to be a little wary about the ability of parents to make decisions for their kids in high-stress situations. Now, again, it's a generalization. All kinds of parents, all kinds of stressful situations, but generally speaking, what's your view about their ability to even participate in decision-making for a very sick child?
For the most part, we want to assume that all parents are thinking about what's best for their child in every situation, and even in the most stressful situations. The issue really is in the extremes, and there's data from the world of psychiatry about adult patients in particular, in terms of their capacity to make medical decisions in their own best interests. And I think that does apply in the case of parents who are at the extremes of stress, whether it's anxiety or depression, especially in parents who may have a history of mental illness, but also in parents who are suffering from grief or even denial and severe denial of their child's condition, that can really, I think, impact their ability to make even adequate decisions.
So when you say denial, you mean they're not recognizing they're sick, or they're overly optimistic about the chances of recovery, or?
I think denial in the sense of the severity of their child's illness, especially in the likelihood that the illness is terminal. I think that presents an extreme situation that for any parent is horrible and can really tax their ability to make decisions.
Chris, you've been in an ICU, pediatric ICU setting for many years. You've dealt with lots and lots of parents from different backgrounds, different cultural, economic circumstances. With a very sick child, What's your view about the ability of parents, generally speaking? I mean, I'm not trying to say every parent is like this, but generally speaking, to engage and be involved in decision making.
Well, my experience after doing this for 35 years is they're surprisingly competent. I think particularly it's interesting when you first meet a family and you see them, and sometimes the parents are very young, and you think there are going to be problems, and for the most part, you're astonished at how well they do. Now, there is a large cultural component, and several places where I've practiced, you certainly see differences, particularly if they have a supportive extended family to help. But I'd have to say that I've only had a few instances in my career where we've been at a terrible impasse. It's astonishing how little that happens.
Are there things that can be done to help the parents along, to make them less stressed out or get them to be more engaged, or even, as Dr. Cohen said, maybe to make them more realistic? I mean, are there ways that we should be thinking about in dealing with any parents, whether it's to get a vaccination or something that's going to happen in the pediatric ICU? How are they best engaged?
Well, as a background, I think this is something that pediatric intensivists in particular do as a group a very excellent job at. I have colleagues in adult intensive care who get into serious conflicts all the time. I think a difference in pediatrics is in pediatric ICUs, the physicians are much more involved in kind of the day-to-day, even minute-to-minute interactions with the families. Now, of course, there's variability there. If you practice in a large medical center with large numbers of layers of trainees and residents and so on, it can be more complicated. But I found in my career that just coming in a lot and engaging the sort of thing that psychiatrists do, which is kind of non-directed questions, just conversation, to try and get a feel for where they're at, and then deal with them multiple times throughout the day and even into the night. I've had many experiences of parents that are initially quite suspicious or even hostile, and with just kind of persistence and patience, you can break through that. So the key is that they have to come to trust you, so that they, when they ask your opinion, and one breakthrough question often is they'll ask you, if this were your child, what would you do? Which you have to deflect that a little bit, but that, I don't know, it's hard to generalize, but mainly it's try and get to know them as best you can over multiple times during their admission, particularly their admission day or night.
You agree with that?
I think for the most part that's true. I do think that it probably varies by region, and I suspect that despite my experience sort of locally in the New York metro area, and I've practiced elsewhere, that it does make a difference having just being there, being present, which traditionally I think intensives in particular were not always in-house, and in pediatrics that's changed. So just, yes, being around, being available can certainly engender trust. At the same time, I think that the nature of how we practice has changed so that it's much more, I think, team-based than it used to be. So we're kind of gone are the days of the solo practitioner, the savior of the world physician, and so we rely heavily on our nursing staff and our sort of nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, and residents to a large extent. And they also have to be involved in the same way.
Well, I'll ask both of you this, and then I'll go toward some of the conflict cases. One thing I've noticed with adult intensive care over the years is not everybody's always on the same page on the team. So somebody can send a message from nursing to the patient's family during the day, and they hear something else from a nurse who comes on the weekend or at night. Do you see that problem arising, and is there a way to make sure that everybody is consistent in what they're telling the parents?
Yeah, we do see that. unfortunately, it's hard to know sometimes what the exact cause is. Mm-hmm. You know, it requires sometimes some investigation. There are sometimes issues of communication, kind of like we were just talking about, where the loop of communication hasn't been closed among the practitioners, nurses, physicians, et cetera. Sometimes, however, it is an outgrowth of nurses' training, much more so than we see in physicians, in having empathy and identifying with the families and being at the bedside the whole time. Sometimes that results in the nurses potentially disagreeing with the overall plan, let's say from day to night, and, you know, bringing in their own value set that may be in alignment with the parents. But sometimes it also has to do with a different level of understanding, and that the nurse may actually know better. So having being at the patient's bedside the whole time, they may actually have information that the team is not aware of, and so that can also complicate things.
How about that, Dr. Johnson, the consistency of message?
Well, that is, I've certainly seen that, and I've practiced most of my career in a very, very large unit with fellows and residents, and now I'm in a somewhat smaller unit. Sometimes there's a problem of people kind of choosing sides in the team, and the parents are very good at picking up on that tension if there's disagreement. And it's not just the intensivists and the nurses. I think there's a larger problem with that is with consulting services. I know certainly what I try and do is personally go in frequently so that even though there is a team, the family knows who's in charge of the team. And I also want to make it clear to them that I'm happy to talk with them at any time, no matter what I'm doing in the day. They don't have one shot at me at rounds. I'm happy to come back. I usually do. And even in the night, I'm happy to talk on the telephone if I'm not physically in the hospital.
How do you manage requests for, let's call it, both the alternative and the experimental?
So it happens all the time. We're fortunate at our hospital, actually, to have an integrative health service. So where you have the availability of complementary alternative medicines or procedures in addition to, standard medical care. Probably the most frequent in this sort of era is marijuana. I see that more in particular because we have an epilepsy center at our institution, and so we see a lot of patients who have, unfortunately, you know, really bad seizures. But we also see it in our oncology population, both for beliefs that it's curative of cancer, but often for pain as well. And practicing palliative care, obviously, I'm going to see that as well. Those things, whether it's marijuana or other, you know, herbal things, things that people can maybe obtain over the counter, unlike marijuana, I think are quite reasonable. But when there are things that are either outside the realm of possibility, either for our facility or for any facility, or especially when it's something that is untested and has likely no relation to what we're trying to treat, that's when I would get concerned, and we would need to have a different conversation.
Yeah, what about that, Dr. Johnson? Now, you get somebody who's seen or heard a report of something, they're mixing up the fact that this drug looks promising for X, but their child actually has Y, but they're demanding X. How far down the road are you willing to go to maybe open a door for them?
Well, a couple of things. I think the background comment to me is that most people don't realize what intensive care is. They don't realize to what extent intensive care is really just supportive until the person heals. Actually, if I were to walk into the unit now and look at the litany of things we're doing, child on a ventilator with influenza, for example, very, very little of what I'm doing is actually curing anything. What I'm doing is supporting body systems until they recover. And the bigger issue is when they, as Dr. Cohen is mentioning, demand therapy that is experimental. I guess I saw a case of that most recently in a child with a malignancy for which the hematology oncologist had nothing further to offer. And they investigated around the country with phase 1 trials and things that and there was nothing available, and the family wanted continuing chemotherapy that was clearly causing suffering in the child. And mm-hmm. we declined to do that.
So do you think that's an issue of conscience, or is that an issue of saying, look, at some point I, as the physician, have to set a limit over what's just too dangerous or not in the child's best interest?
I think that, we have an ethical standard in medicine that we cannot cause suffering that has virtually no prospect of benefit. Now, there are some treatments that you could think of, some that would not necessarily cause suffering, but still have a dubious benefit, if any. That's a little different category. And when I evaluate requests for what parents want, that plays very large role in my mind.
What about you, Moshe? Do you have a parent who's adamant? This kid's got a glioblastoma or end-stage blood cancer. I want you to continue aggressive intervention.
I think we generally, and obviously I can't necessarily speak for other subspecialties, but I think we would want to be open to at least having a discussion. And that's my bias in being a palliative care doc, is that, you know, communication becomes key to all these conversations. Mm-hmm. But if I were to take a step back and remember that we're living in an age where whatever we say in the hospital is going to have some website or Dr. Google that's going to trump mm-hmm. what we say. I think if we are not experts in, you know, using, I don't know, rocks and pebbles from my driveway to, you know, to treat cancer, and the parents aren't either, then we perhaps bring someone who might have something to say and then maybe come to an agreement. But if it's simply the push because of some underlying reason, which I think psychologically, emotionally, culturally mm-hmm. is usually the case, then I think we have to take a step back and reconsider whether we should even entertain the possibility.
I'll ask both of you this. Have you been asked whether or not you would pray with a patient or a family?
All the time.
Yes, although I'm a Quaker, so praying consists of saying nothing.
My son went to a Quaker school. I'm very familiar with that, yeah. Here's why I asked you, and I'll go to Dr. Johnson first. Sometimes we get religious reasons to want to do something or not do something, depending. Some of the cases, again, that we began the show talking about that I presented involved God doesn't want this child to live, or prayer might be more effective than medical intervention. How do you manage that when faith is the driver for the parent?
Well, the answer to that is fairly clear cut, I think, as these cases have shown. And that is that, an adult of 18 is able to do what they want, but we have an interest in the child. And it was about 10 years ago, an interesting case of a child in Minnesota who wanted to forego cancer therapy. And he, after extensive interviews, the judge certified him as an emancipated minor and able to make his own decisions. But in general, a request like that to replace a known effective therapy, we might have to go to court, but we have to take a stand against that.
So I think we do see the sort of religious objections to treatment sometimes, or religious requests for treatment. Classic cases of blood transfusions and Christian Scientists in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. diabetes. The famous cases, in terms of insulin refusal. But now, where religion is then used to specifically push for experimental treatment, because therefore God mm-hmm. or whichever deity is going to then, you know, make a cure possible, is definitely more challenging. Meeting parents sort of on that plane, I think, then requires outside help. Mm-hmm. Because in as much as we want to allow them to advocate for their child, it may harm the child if we sort of allow it to go that far. The flip side is also when there is not a consensus in the medical field about either certain treatments, the risk benefits, outcomes, or perhaps most contentiously is brain death. Mm-hmm. And that becomes much more complicated.
Do either of you feel comfortable going to an ethics committee to get help or assistance? Have you ever done that? Is it proven useful in these rare but contentious cases, Dr. Johnson?
Yes, I do that not infrequently. Partly because, like most ethics committees, ours here and the one that I've had in the past, involve a fairly diverse group of people, a good chunk of whom are not even in the medical field. And so I think I've had several instances where that's been extremely helpful. At least in my state, I'm only aware of Texas, I think, where they have the right to completely overrule on the basis of ethics committee. In general, I found that to be useful. It tends to diffuse issues to and also kind of depersonalize them if there's some personal animus between and the family.
You use them?
Still do in different capacities. I've had the experience of training in an institution where there was a clinical ethics committee, so ethicists could come to the bedside and actually do an actual consult the way a subspecialist would. And currently we have sort of both a clinical ethics sort of aspect, but also a more sort of philosophical or committee-based ethics committee. And where I am now, we also have a clinical service, but including a committee-based ethics service, mm-hmm. and both of them can be beneficial.
So the question I want to push to you is, when there may be a battle, do you follow up? Can you be sure that even if something is done which the parents might not be comfortable with, can we make sure that we don't draw some kind of division in the family or between the mom and the dad or the family and the kid? I'm just feeling to see, we may win that battle but could lose a war, won't you?
Yeah, I had a very similar situation when I was training. And it was very complicated. It involved multiple committees where a young child who had ended up having necrosing fasciitis and had to have multiple amputations. And the mother refused the surgeries. And we ended up going to court to get the surgery done. One of the challenges for us ethically was that the child remained on a ventilator awaiting the surgery, which a ventilator he didn't necessarily need until such time as he could have the surgery. So there were multiple aspects to it. He had the surgery, and ultimately the mother did disengage from the child because culturally the child was then seen as less than human, despite the fact that subsequently the child had state-of-the-art prosthetics, was doing fabulously well, but that disengagement had happened. And
ever had a follow-up problem like that, Dr. Johnson?
Not exactly like that, but it's a risk. It's a risk we have to take in doing the working in the best interest of the child. I guess the most valid things we had is a very tight-knit family with a mother, grandmother, and a child with new-onset diabetes. Now, diabetes is a pretty standard, ordinary thing, but to several members in a family, having to take insulin every day was a disability that made them not exactly shun that child, but swerve. And of course, we had to do the best for the child. And so it was one of those unfortunate things that can happen. Something like that can happen anyway. The more difficult ones are where the risk-benefit ratio is not so clear-cut, and the parents are reluctant to, I think, an emerging situation for that in my career is the evolution of how we manage hypoplastic left heart syndromes. Mm-hmm. I saw a poll some years ago amongst cardiologists, and something like half of them would not have recommended for their own child to go through.
That's the one with the big the surgeries and the Norwood procedures, and yeah.
And some say the Norwood is the heart transplant. So those are the more difficult ones, or ECMO, for example, in a situation where ECMO is not, the statistics aren't very good, but the physicians recommend it and the parents are a little more reluctant. Those are always the tough ones. But I guess I have to say, as we move along toward the end, is that I have only had really one occasion where we really reached a total impasse. And in every with time, and we have to allow a lot of time. And I think part of this debate, unfortunately, with children who are disabled, chronic ventilator kids and stuff, is that we have a compulsion to want to reach decisions soon. And before, I think if there's an element of suffering in the child, then that does compel us. But if they're not suffering, we can have time. My feeling about parental role in this is that maybe it's because I'm a Quaker, but I mean, most people are going to be reasonable and eventually, and if we give it some time. And I in a big, busy unit that is got a good, what happens is with a child who's been there a very long time is the staff kind of tends to disengage a little bit. It's the nursing staff gets a little restless. You need to have a lot of sessions with them to try and, you know, what are we doing this for, and so on. Well, we're doing it for the child and the family to try and get everyone so that they're in a place, as I often tell families, the decisions we make now, I want you to be happy with them in 5 years, or at least content. And you have to have that element in all of it.
If you were trying to suggest ways to avoid battles, avoid these clashes, any words of wisdom that you want to impart?
So I would agree with Dr. Johnson that time is certainly your friend most of the time, that allowing those discussions to happen, communication, letting parents adjust, that's certainly important. When we do make these decisions or have these conversations, each party, whether it's physician, family, ethics committee, whatever it is, has to have the information appropriate for them at their level that will enable them to participate.
I want to say it's been a real pleasure to have both of you here. I hope that you took away from this discussion some of the wisdom that our experienced practitioners have here in grappling with these ethical and moral dilemmas, and I want to thank you for watching Both Sides Now.